we begin this afternoon, some folk asked me if I would give you the locations, the citations of where you can find some of the references that I used this morning with respect to the battle for the mind. So very quickly, let's run through just some of those issues. First of all, Ellen White spoke of how the Satan would use one human mind as a very powerful agent to operate on other human minds. And that can be done oftentimes without the individual even realizing that they're subject to that influence. If you want to do a little research of your own on that, look it up in Selected Messages, Volume 2, page 352. 2SM 352. She also described how in the future, in the very midst of us, would arise false teachers, and then her language is kind of unique. I can't characterize it, so I'll just read a little bit of it to you. She said, creeping in unawares, they will use flattering words and make skillful misrepresentations with seductive tact, and that people would be drawn into error. Once they were drawn in, it seemed almost impossible to break them free. If you want to look that up for yourself, here are the reference sources. First of all, you'll need to get a hold of Special Testimonies. Series B, number 7, page 30. Now, if that proves to be a problem for you, because the denomination has never published Special Testimonies in any of our published works, that is all located in my new book, Omega 2. And Kathy will have those this evening available, I think. You brought some, did you? Okay. Omega 2, and you could find it either in Special Testimony, Series B, number 7, page 30, or if you want to do the other route, you can find it in Omega 2 on page 73. Now let's see if we can find just some more of the references you need to know about. Here's one that I'm not sure I had time to mention this morning. Back in the Kellogg era, it is very obvious that Ellen White was identifying that certain kinds of psychological mechanisms were being used then. She described them explicitly, and you can recognize from her descriptions of 90 years ago the very thing that is being done today by some New Age and other gurus who are using some of these neuroprogramming systems. Well, Ellen White said, it's happening back then, it will all happen again in Adventism, and she said, when it does occur, watch out because probation is about to close. Now, that is one text that I want to read to you because I don't think I read it this morning. She said, through the channels of psychology and hypnotism, Satan works with that power which is to characterize his efforts near the close of probation. When it happens, watch out, folk, because we're near the end of probation. Now, the citation for that is Selected Messages, Volume 2, page 351. I'm giving you these because I think it's terribly important that you folk do your own research. You shouldn't just listen to me. I could be wrong. Look it up for yourself. All right, let's move on and see if we can find a few other areas in which I think her descriptions would be very, very good. Let's move over here to the area of music. She talks about how just before the close of probation, there will be some strange changes in the way music is presented to the people of God. Probably the most definitive source there would be Selected Messages, Volume 2, pages 35 and 36. Now, let me share with you something that I didn't have time to share with you this morning. And that is not from an inspired source, but it's kind of interesting and it gives you a little insight into what can happen. Back in 1900, right at the turn of the century, there apparently was this same kind of problem with respect to worship style. Now, what did I tell you last night that, in my opinion, was trying to happen at the turn of the century? The Lord was trying to come. It is evident both from the way he was blessing the church and from the way world events were moving, that we were in an end time world. The only reason Jesus did not come close to the turn of the century is that God's people apostatized and held the coming of Christ up for a good 9 decades. Well, at that time, Mrs. S.N. Haskell was writing. Now, Mrs. Haskell was, of course, the wife of Elder Haskell. He was a major figure in early Adventism. And she wrote to Sarah McInturfer, who was the housekeeper of the White household. And here is what she said about what was going on in Indiana. She said, "We have a big drum, 2 tambourines, a big bass fiddle, 2 small fiddles, a flute and cornet, an organ, and a few voices." She went on to say how they sang from a relatively popular songbook. They were moving from the old Advent hymns into a more popular music variety. Then here's what was going on in the meetings. Mrs. Haskell says they shout amen and praise the Lord, glory to God, just like a Salvation Army service. It is distressing to one's soul. The doctrines preached correspond to the rest. The poor sheep are truly confused. Well, there's nothing wrong with saying amen. There's sure nothing wrong with saying praise the Lord. I don't think she was getting at that. Evidently, the service was getting kind of noisy, kind of disorderly. So that was happening back then. Now, this one on theatrics that I read to you, where she said the Lord cannot be glorified by theatrical exhibitions, comes from manuscript release 909. That's one you're going to have to get from the White Estate. If you want to do a little research on that, write the White Estate and see if you can get a hold of manuscript release 909. Well, I think we've covered most of what you need, except that we will go back and remind you that the quotation where it talks about how Satan has been working to learn how to work on the human mind and that he's trying to bring our minds into harmony with his own, you'll have to find that one in the book Mind, Character, and Personality, page 698. Now, because of the shortness of time this morning, we're always, of course, needing to be as time efficient as we can on Sabbath morning, and I didn't want to talk longer, it wouldn't have been appropriate. But there's one area of mind manipulation that I need to at least make you aware of, and that's the area of mysticism and meditation. Do those terms ring any bells with you? Now, aren't we as Christians supposed to meditate? What did David say? In thy law I meditate how much of the time? Day and night. So meditation is a very biblical thing. So it has to be a very good thing. Now remember what we said this morning. Every time the devil sees that the Lord has a good idea, he tries to counterfeit it. And the devil has tried to counterfeit Christian meditation. And he has done it with brilliant success inside Christianity using the vehicle of mysticism. Now, do you folk understand what mysticism is? Let me define it for you real quickly because it's kind of important to know. Mysticism is found in many Eastern religions, but it's also found in some varieties of Christianity. And what mysticism is an attempt to form a mystical fusion between man and God. Now, the Zen Buddhist believes, for example, if you can deny your current reality and let your mind go blank and meditate sufficiently, you can unify your mind with the mind of God, and you get this unification of the human being with the divine. That's mysticism. Now, mysticism has crept into Christianity principally through some vehicles like the Jesuit order. You folk understand how the Jesuits got started? There was a Spaniard by the name of Inigo de Loyola. He was a soldier. He wasn't religious at all. He led a very irreligious life. One day he was in battle in Spain. A French cannonball came up, burst against the wall where he was standing. It hit his legs. It very badly injured him, and it left him with a limp all his life. Well, as he was recovering from these injuries, Loyola began to think about his life, and he began feeling guilty. I guess he had a lot of good reasons to feel that way. The more he thought about it, the more he decided he wanted to become a very devout individual. He wanted to become a soldier for the Blessed Mother. He pursued this very intensively, and he began to have what he thought were visions, mystical visions. Pretty soon, he was having visions every day. Now, he developed a system whereby he could induce these visions. What he would do, essentially, you would progressively relax the body. You would let your mind go blank so you're not thinking about the world around you. And then you would focus on one scene out of Scripture, like a scene out of the life of Jesus. Then you would begin to create with your imagination that scene as though you're drawing it in your mind. You would create landscape and weather and clouds and people. All of this stuff the Bible has not specifically told us about, but he would do this in his mind. Then he would create a person in that scene, and many, many times that person was supposed to be Jesus. Now, it got a little weird from this point on. Then the next thing you do is you talk to this person that you have imaged in your mind. You ask them questions, and guess what, folk? They answer back. Mysticism. Loyola found that to be very powerful. He wrote a book called The Spiritual Exercises of St. Ignatius. That book is the basis for becoming a Jesuit priest. You do this for 4 straight weeks. You don't say a word. You're sworn to silence. You cannot utter a word. The retreat master up front takes you through what is called guided meditation. And you are required to formulate these images in your mind, to talk to these things you create, and you hear stuff coming back. Now, let me ask you a question. When you talk to something that ain't there and you get an answer, who are you hearing from? I am convinced this is the entry doorway for spiritualism. Now, why am I taking a 5 minutes or so to this afternoon when I have other material I really want to present to talk about this? Simply because this monster is trying to knock on the door of Adventism today. And there are those today, even among us, who are beginning to practice this sort of mystical meditation. Well, that leaves you folk with a question. If the psalmist said that you are supposed to meditate, and Ellen White recommends meditation too, and yet there's a form of meditation that's dangerous and possibly could lead you to an occult experience, how are you going to tell the difference between them? That's the bread and butter question. And I've thought a lot about that, and I think I have an answer that's reasonably good. When you go to meditate, ask yourself, what is it that I am doing? Am I using my conscious mind, my frontal lobes, to think about information that the Bible has already revealed? Or am I using my imagination to come up with things that the Bible has never specifically described, and in the process, am I more apt to be accessing my subconscious rather than my conscious? Now, if you're doing the first, if you're consciously thinking about biblical or revealed truth, then you're practicing meditation, aren't you? But if you're dipping the bucket into the well of your subconscious and you're trying to come up with things that the Bible's never revealed, you're probably closer to Zen than you are to Adventism. So there's a difference there. I hope you folk never encounter this thing. Out in California, we already have, but then again, where else would you find it but California? So anyway, it's just a thought that I want to kind of share with you. I'm a little concerned that Adventists don't be led astray on some of these things. Okay, let's move on. The topic for this afternoon is education. On a June day in 1904, very pleasant, very pretty June day down in Nashville, Tennessee, Ellen White wrote a letter, and she was anything but a happy camper. Ellen White was very deeply upset. Why was she upset? Because she had just learned that a new college had been opened up in Battle Creek. Actually, not opened so much as reopened. It was supposedly an Adventist college. Now, why would Ellen White, who loved Adventist young people and loved education, why would she get all upset because suddenly another Adventist college had opened up? I'll tell you why. At that very moment, the church was embroiled in a terrible confrontation. There's a very powerful group of very bright, very intellectually oriented people, including very well-trained ministers and very well-trained physicians, who were breaking away from mainstream Adventism and offering a form of new theology. What were they offering? Their new theology led to enormous confusion on the sanctuary. If you bought into their theories, the sanctuary made no sense anymore. You had to get rid of it. Along with this was a collapse of standards. In just a few moments, we're going to see how Adventist moral standards were collapsing. They were falling like a grand piano. I mean, this stuff got into the front pages of the Chicago newspaper. It got that bad. So standards were collapsing. Along with this, there were a lot of people in Battle Creek in this little core of change agents who were very antagonistic to Ellen White. I think you get the picture. In other words, Adventism in its unique features was being severely challenged by a little core of people determined to change the church. These are the ones who had established this new college. Now, what did they do? Well, they began printing up lovely brochures inviting Adventist young people to come to Battle Creek. They began sending recruiters out in the camp meeting season. Right about this time of year, the recruiters from Battle Creek went out from camp meeting, urging Adventist young people, hey, come to Battle Creek because that's where we got the best program for you. So Ellen White was just a little bit concerned. Oh, by the way, there was one other thing this group of people were doing. They were trying to seize political control of the church. I'm serious. There were plans afoot to seize political control of the church. Something or somebody was trying to get control of Adventism. Well, so they start the new school, and Ellen White gets concerned. And on a June day in 1904, she writes the following kind of language. How could we consent to have the flower of our youth called to Battle Creek when God has given warning after warning they're not to gather there? Something very dangerous there for young people. Now, think it through. Battle Creek at this time is what? It's really the heart and center of Adventism. We have at that place one of our greatest world centers. Our largest church is in Battle Creek. Our flagship healthcare institution is at Battle Creek. Until just recently, the General Conference had been there, as had been the publishing work. So it's a major Adventist center. Yet Ellen White says, keep your kids away from there. If you send them there, you're liable to see them lose their souls. Well, I guess if we got an ounce of curiosity this afternoon, we'd probably be asking what on earth was wrong with the school. And there were about three things that were. Number one, some of the teachers there didn't even understand really what it meant to be an Adventist. They physically didn't know. Now, in Ellen White's words, she said, some who stand there as leaders and teachers do not understand the real groundwork of our faith. That's number one. Maybe that's enough, don't you think? If you're going to send your kids to an Adventist school, it would be kind of nice if the teachers at least understand what it means to be an Adventist. But that's not all the problems there were. Point number two. Some of them not only didn't understand Adventism, they were antagonistic to it. And in Ellen White's words, they will work to undermine the confidence of those in whose minds they can plant the seeds of doubt. So you got a couple classes of people, or some of them don't know what it means to be an Adventist, and others of them are so antagonistic that where they get the chance, they're going to bore into that student's mind and plant the seeds of doubt there. But that's not all the problems they had. Number three, some of them were very, very hostile to the spirit of prophecy. Now, in Ellen White's words again, she said they hate the testimonies and refuse to follow the light given by God. Okay, if you want to look this stuff up for yourself, two places you can do it. One of them would be Special Testimonies, Series B, number 7, pages 33 and 34. If you don't have access to that, it's in my book, Omega 2, beginning on page 56. So there are a couple places you can find it. Well, not surprisingly now, when you consider the problems that are there at Battle Creek, three big ones, what do you suppose is going to happen to the kids who graduate from there? They're going to graduate from this school without a clue as to what it really means to be an Adventist, right? Sure, it's exactly what happened. Ellen White put it this way. Many of those who have been educated in Battle Creek need to learn the first principles of present truth. I mean, it's ironic, but it's sad. Adventist parents have sent their kids to a school thinking they're going to be trained to be Adventist, and they come away at best confused and at worst hostile to the faith. Now, this kind of language from Ellen White is pretty blunt. You know, it's not culturally correct, not politically correct. You know, in the church today, we don't talk like that very much. It's not considered correct to be that frank. And so it's a little hard for me to stand up and read some of this stuff because it comes through my mouth and therefore I seem to be saying it, but I want you to be real clear. All I'm doing is quoting what she put in black and white. These were her concerns. Now, she can sound at this point a little bit severe, perhaps a little critical, don't you think? But before we sit in armchair judgment on her, think about it, folk. There is nothing in this world as important or valuable to a parent as the life of a girl or a boy that you have watched grow up. I mean, beside the worth of your children, the big screen TV, the pension plan, the two-car garage, all that stuff can just, you know, be tossed out. It doesn't measure up. Your kids are the most important thing you have. So that when parents send their children to college, they are entitled to expect that college will treat those young people in such a way that they're going to come out the other end as Adventists. Now, it has been said, and I think very correctly so, that there are two times in life when a person can really be molded. Okay? One of those times of life is the stage that little Sarah is. You know, that young infant I was looking at here a few minutes ago who's 4 months old. When you have an infant, you can really mold that child, can't you? There's one more time you got a shot at them. Now, you parents think by the time your kids are like 11, 12, 13, 14, that's it. You know, there's no talking to them anymore. You can't change their mind. They are really pretty much set in their ways, but they're not. There is another chance to change that person. You know when it comes? In the college years. Studies show that's the second chance to mold that individual. So that if you want to change that person, you've got a chance in the 4 years from freshman to senior to absolutely change that individual. One of the reasons is by this time, they know that what they're studying now means their whole future. And they tend to listen, they tend to give a lot of credence to faculty, for example, who have a lot of credibility, control their grades, and have a lot of prestige. So that in the college years, when you're making decisions like, what am I going to do for a living, who am I going to marry, and am I going to be saved eternally, that's critically important. So that when a parent sends a son or daughter to college, you are reposing in that campus the highest trust you can repose in anything on planet Earth. Well, in Battle Creek, something's going wrong. The young people of the church are beginning to be used as pawns in what is a power struggle between two very powerful opposing factions. And Dr. Kellogg begins to use the young people of the church in a political way. So Ellen White stands up on her hind legs and she says, and I quote, "God forbid that one word of encouragement should be spoken to call our youth to a place where they will be leavened by misrepresentations." Now, let's just be real sure we understand what we're saying here. The problems that led her to urge people not to send their students to a given campus are the following. Number one, instructors who didn't understand basic Adventism. Instructors who were hostile to Adventism and the spirit of prophecy. Students who graduated without even knowing the first principles of present truth. In other words, on that campus, kids are going to get exposed to attacks on the most distinctive identities of Adventism. Well, there was a danger in 1904 that they're going to get exposed to a little more than that. Because along with this new theology was coming a collapse of standards. Now, in Battle Creek, they were beginning to get confused on morality. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how the devil uses moral issues as the bait to draw people into error. That's what happened to the children of Israel just before they crossed the Jordan River. Balaam couldn't curse them. He couldn't control his own tongue when he's trying to curse the children of Israel, but he figured out a way to bring a curse on them. What was it, folk? It's an old-fashioned thing called the seventh commandment, isn't it? And maybe it's time for us to rediscover that commandment. In Battle Creek in 1904, that was a major issue. The moral collapse there was such it began to get into the press. Dr. Wagner's divorce made the first page of a major Chicago newspaper. One of the new theologians there at Battle Creek came up with a bizarre idea he called spiritual affinity. You know what that was? He was suggesting that your wife in heaven just might be a different person than your wife on earth had been. Now, the ultimate effects of that theology here and now can best be left to the imagination, but I think you can see the problems that were brewing there. So to send your kids to that environment would expose them not only to false theology, but to some immoral practices. Would you want to hazard a guess that kids that were sent there might just be at risk of losing their confidence in the church? Well, if you think so, you're absolutely right. As early as 1906, just 2 years later, Ellen White began to get these letters from the field. They were addressed to her, and she put it this way. You can find this if you want to research it for yourself in Manuscript 20 from 1906. Here are Ellen White's words. One father writes that of his two children who were sent to Battle Creek, one is now an infidel and the other has given up the truth. Letters such as this have been coming from different ones. Now, folk, I know a little of this from personal experience. Several years ago, I was speaking down at Loma Linda University, and after the meeting, when I'd been talking about the Omega problem, up came Dr. Dick Neal. Anybody here know him? He's an African-American physician, very fine physician. He came to me and he said, you know, this plugs into the story of my family. He says, back a few generations in my family, after the Civil War, my family was coming north out of slavery. They located for a time in Battle Creek, Michigan. Some of them left before the Kellogg apostasy, and that section of the family is all still solidly Adventist. They're still in the church. But those who stayed through this era left, and that part of the family is no longer Adventist. So something very strange is happening in Adventism there, and Ellen White said, who is responsible for giving young men and women an education that has left a seducing influence on their minds? Then she gave parents some advice. You know what it was? She said, parents, keep your children away from Battle Creek. If your children are there, call them away without delay. Well, the saddest irony of all, quite frankly, is that God had given us such a clear plan for education, hadn't He? We had a blueprint for how to educate our young people right. Now, it ran contrary to some human presuppositions and a little bit of institutional vanity, because it said, don't ever let an institution get too big. If you get it too big, you're going to collect under a single administration a lot of young people, and then their welfare is dependent on the spirituality of whoever's running the place. So number one, keep the institution small. Number two, wherever possible, put them out in the country. Keep them rural. Now, on rural, small campuses, Ellen White emphasized that young people could really get what's called a balanced education, a holistic education. Not only are you working the mind, but when the mind has reached all of the production it can accomplish for one day, you've got to switch over and you have to balance that with what? Physical work so that the entire person is educated. Well, in a country setting, she said you can do that the best. So So her idea was, don't just teach your kids academic subjects, but also teach them a useful trade so that if sometime, heaven forbid, they lose their job, they got something else to fall back on. Does that make a little bit of sense? Now, for a Magic Johnson who comes through the Adventist educational system and is so skilled that he gets to be big time in the basketball league, for example, maybe that kind of advice isn't necessary. But for the average Adventist young person who isn't beating off major ball club recruiters with a stick, it might be real nice to have a secondary job, don't you think? Makes a little bit of sense. Oh, by the way, what did Paul do when on occasion he needed a little money? Yeah, he fell back on a secondary career. So Ellen White says, be sure our young people go out so that they're really trained to be able to be economically viable. Hey, there's something else she said, and I know I'm going to risk sounding like somebody out of the dark ages, but, you know, that's the advantage of being a visitor. I mean, tomorrow morning I fly out of here. Okay? One other thing Ellen White said about education is be real careful about getting our kids heavily involved in something called competitive sports. Now, I know that sounds pretty antediluvian. I know it does. And I fully understand that sports are a very big part of our young people's lives today, and we would an awful lot rather see our young people shooting baskets than shooting each other, wouldn't we? Sure we would. But might there still be a little bit of rationale behind what she says about a heavy emphasis in a lot of sports competition? Well, I can think of one thing that might still have some validity. Now, think it through. And in the average sporting event, what are you going to have? You're going to have winners, and you're going to have losers, aren't you? That's the way sports are played. Somebody wins, somebody loses. Now, is that the way the plan of salvation works? In the plan of salvation, we don't compete against anybody. Indeed, our job is not to compete with people, but to help them get there too. There are no losers, you see? Now, in sports, the idea is you try your very best to make a goal, to make a basket or whatever, and somebody else's job is to keep you from getting there. What we're really saying here is that the way we've structured sports is they are a form of acted out combat. Think it through, and that's a fact. And by the way, folk, so are many of our video games and other things. They're kind of an acted out combat. Well, now if that is so, then is there a possibility that if our young people get heavily involved, so that this is a predominant thought in their mind, of competitive sports, and the idea is I win and somebody else is going to have to lose so I can win, have we really trained them so that they're ready to spread a gospel that says everybody wins? It's just a thought. It's something to think about. I really honestly think we shouldn't be either judgmental or harsh with these things. And Ellen White, who says, gives us this kind of advice, also says, if you're going to make a mistake, if you err, err on the side of the people you're trying to win. And let's don't portray to our young people a rigid atmosphere where they can't seem to think they're going to have any fun at all. I don't mean that. But wouldn't it be better if we can show them that somehow in some of these old-fashioned writings from the church are embedded the secrets of their own future success? That seems like it might be well worth doing. Well, Ellen White gave us a pretty clear blueprint for how to educate our young people. And the core, the axle around which everything else turned was, our schools were designed to train evangelists. Well, why? Because, folk, our job is not planning for the next 50 years on this earth. If our young people could come out of our schools really well trained and really committed, folk, those young people with their energy could finish the work of God in a generation. In other words, our schools were designed to bring young people through the pipeline, give them the technical skills they needed, the best education they could get, and the conviction that their job now was to be a missionary. Maybe a missionary to Africa, or maybe a missionary to Newark, but a missionary. You might go overseas, or you might go to some little town, for example, that has never before had an Adventist presence. You start your business or you start your practice there, and you witness until that community knows about the gospel. And I have seen towns where there had never been an Adventist presence. One Adventist general practitioner, a medical doctor, moves into town, and about 20 years later, there's a thriving church and a thriving school. That's how it was supposed to work. Well, so the idea is you train our young people to recognize they're revolutionaries. They're the shock troops of the revolution. They have the capacity to get this war over with. And they're going to go to some hot tropical climates where there's a lot of inconvenience. There'll be mosquitoes and perspiration and termites, but don't worry about them, kids, because if you do your job well, you won't be there that long. And we're going to check out of here and we're going straight up. That's Adventism. That's what our schools were designed to be. Oh, by the way, what were the names we used to give to our schools? Southern Missionary College, Emmanuel Missionary College, Washington Missionary College, College of Medical Evangelists. Now, where do brethren get those archaic names from? Sounds a little provincial, doesn't it? Tell you where they got those names from. That was a description of what our schools were supposed to do. I can roll with the flow. I understand times change. But once in a while, I have to admit, I get a little nostalgic for the era in which we, without embarrassment or reservation, told the world exactly where we're coming from and what we intended to do. Well, she also had some advice with respect to hiring faculty members. Only place in the world that a young person could get a clear Adventist education would be on our campuses. Why? Because they got to understand the third angel's message, and you won't get it anywhere else. Nobody else in this world understands the sanctuary. We have to have Adventist schools. And as a result of that, she gave us a warning. Be real careful who we hire as teachers. Let me share something with you from manuscript 125, 1907. If you want to look it up in a published source, then you'll have to look up The Upward Look. It's a morning watch book, an Ellen White morning watch book from 1982. The Upward Look, page 199. And here's what she has to say. Any man who seeks to present theories which would lead us from the light on the heavenly sanctuary should not be accepted as a teacher. Upward Look, page 199. And then she said, in Special Testimonies, Series B, number 7, page 63, all of this higher education that is planned will be extinguished, for it is spurious. The more simple the education of our workers, the less connection they have with men whom God is not leading, the more will be accomplished. Work will be done in the simplicity of true godliness, and the old times will be back when, under the Spirit's guidance, thousands were converted in a day. That's the function of education. If you happen to have your Bible with you, you might enjoy turning with me to Luke 19. Luke chapter 19, and you'll want to look up the 40th verse. Luke 19, verse 40. And Jesus is speaking, and here is what he has to say. And he answered and said unto them, I tell you, that if these should hold their peace, the very stones would immediately cry out. Well, as Adventists, we differ from our Catholic neighbors in a lot of ways. Got a lot of differences from the Catholics. The change of the Sabbath is one. The veneration of Mary, the persecution of the Middle Ages, even the intrusion of an earthly priest into the sanctuary ministry of Christ. All of that makes us very different from our Adventist friends. But you know something? Once in a while, the stones cry out. Now this afternoon, you're going to hear some stones talking. For 7 years of my educational life, I was a student on a Roman Catholic campus. I still receive a lot of Catholic literature, which I do read because I need to know what they're thinking and where they're going. And in October of 1993, I was reading a Catholic magazine called Crisis. It's put out by very, very conservative, very devout, very sincere Catholic people. And it described in one of its articles a Catholic university. Let me tell you the story and see what you make of this. In Steubenville, Ohio, there's a Catholic university called Franciscan University. And back a few years ago, it was just collapsing. I mean, enrollment was down to barely 1,000 students. The dean of students came around to the president and he says, we might as well quit holding Sunday morning mass because nobody's getting up for it. They lost their president, which is not surprising, and they began hunting for a new one. The first three candidates for presidency looked the thing place over and said, hey, don't bother us with it, just shut the thing down. Then they called on a priest by the name of Michael Scanlon, a Catholic priest. Yeah, I'm talking a guy with his collar on backward, okay? Scanlon came to the search committee. He says, okay, folk, if you want me to run this place, you need to know something. I am going to make this institution stand for Christian and Catholic values. Well, he never expected to be called back for another interview, but wonder of wonders, they offered him the job. He says, okay, before I take the job, now I'm going to talk to the whole board of trustees. I want you all sitting there because I have something to say. And here's what he said. If I take this job, I will lead a spiritual revolution, leading a clear commitment to Jesus Christ as the way, the truth, and the life. Well, his arrival was stormy. He was greeted by the students. You know what they wanted? Totally open dorms, co-ed dorms, no restrictions, doors open. You know what his response was? You are going to have dormitories that are households of faith, and I, as your president, will become your spiritual leader. Well, he then began to monitor faculty performance. He had some faculty there teaching things that were totally unrecognizable as Catholicism, promoting issues he wasn't comfortable with. He began cracking down on that, and as a result of that, his young faculty members tried to call a meeting to get the whole faculty to pass a vote of no confidence in the new president. Something else he did, kind of interesting. You know what? One of the first reforms he instituted was he terminated all intercollegiate athletics. You know why? Let me give it to you in his words. He said, I wanted to clarify the school's principles. That reform cost him some angry telephone calls from the alumni. Now, at this point, you're going to follow the story better if I give it to you in his words. He has a very interesting story to tell. And he said, I found prayer to be my greatest resource. I prayed fervently for God's help, especially when I was in desperate need, including financial need. Some mornings I would stay in prayer for 3 or 4 hours asking the Lord what to do before going to the office. Why go to the office when you don't know what to do? Now, in Selected Messages, Book 3, page 386, Ellen White has something to say. Listen up. God has children, many of them in the Protestant churches and a large number in the Catholic churches who are more true to the light than a large number among Seventh-day Adventists who do not walk in the light. Do you follow me? Well, Robert E. Lee used to have a little idiosyncrasy. When he'd bark an order to his junior officers, you know, he'd always want to be sure he was understood. So he'd be out there on the line and said, General, Colonel Gibbon, you'll come over here.
says, I need to have General Longstreet's corps attack the enemy left. Do you understand me, sir? At which point the young colonel would put leather on the neck of his horse, say, yes, sir, and get moving, see? Well, I'm going to borrow a little chapter from Robert E. Lee's book this afternoon. Do you understand me? Am I making myself clear? We are hearing here from outside the denomination something that just might be worth listening to. And Ellen White says there will be people out there more true to the light than some of us. Well, today, Franciscan University is a very different place. Enrollment has tripled. In Father Scanlon's words, our chapel is filled twice a day for Mass. We have added five chapels to serve the increasing number of students who make daily prayer a priority. Our 12 priests are overrun with requests for the sacrament of reconciliation. Now, I understand, I'm fully aware, that Franciscan University is a charismatic Catholic campus. I know what I'm talking about here. I'm not saying that we agree with their theology, but there's a lesson to be learned here. A university got turned around. A lot of times we hear the argument, even within the church, well, we can't do anything about the moral standards on our campus because the kids come here expecting this. This is what they want. This is what they learn at home. We're stuck with it. Folk, this guy wasn't stuck. And he proved that when a supposedly conservative campus really lives for the ideals it claims to believe in, you can have kids beating down the door to get in. Well, how'd the transformation take place? Because a university president took a stand. He's often asked by visitors, what's the secret of your school's success? And he replies, and let me give it to you in his words, where is your president? What are his priorities and values? That's where it all begins. Now, for those of the Catholic faith who would want to duplicate his experience on other campuses, he has some advice to offer. Let me share it with you. See if there's anything in here that we could find useful. Remembering that where he uses the word Catholic, you want to change that word and insert the word Adventist. But see if he has anything that makes sense. Number one, don't compromise with standards. Make the school's program, in his words, an overtly Catholic and Christian. Point number two, be sure the school's curriculum is, quote, based on Catholic truths. If a Catholic school doesn't stand for Catholic principles, Scanlon says, quote, we shouldn't call it Catholic. Well, I think he's maybe right, don't you suppose? Point number three, hire and terminate faculty based not just on their academic credentials, but, quote, on their support for the school's mission. Number four, give students an environment so clearly religious that wrongdoing seems out of place. When he was confronted with a demand for open dorms, what did he do? He said, you're going to have faith households. He personally took over the duty of being campus pastor, and today the campus's chapels, five of them, are packed with students during devotions. Well, in that same interesting issue of Crisis Magazine, back in 1993, I saw another article, companion article, written by C. John McCloskey III. That's quite an impressive name, isn't it? Got an impressive job, too. He's a campus chaplain for Opus Dei. You ever heard of Opus Dei? A very powerful, sometimes somewhat shadowy Catholic organization. He's near Princeton University. His little article was entitled, Choosing a College, a Parent's Guide. Let me read some of his recommendations to you. Now, of course, being a priest, he's going to frame these in Catholic terms. But once again, see if his ideas maybe have some wider generic application. Point number one from Father McCloskey is this. The very heart of a university, he says, is its sound theology department. Is it loyal to the teachings of the church? Quote, a college that habitually tolerates teaching that is at odds with the church's teaching forfeits the name Catholic in any real sense. End of quote. Point number two. Look at a list of those who have spoken on campus during the past year. Do those visiting speakers support your religious ideals? Now, McCloskey puts it this way. After all, why should your tuition money support the dissemination of opinion antithetical to Catholic teaching? Point number three. Is there a real sense of mission on campus? In other words, does that school exist to prepare students not just for careers, but for a life of religious conviction? Number four. What percentage of the student body really practice their faith? You might just want to know before sending your child there, don't you think? Because that child of yours is liable to marry one of those other students. Number five. This is a scary one. What are the dormitories like? He said, try spending a night in one of them if you dare. Do the dormitories have the same moral tone that you would wish for your child if he or she were living at home? Remember, he says, quote, it is your child you may be placing at moral and physical risk. Number six. He says, finally, do not be fooled by those who purport to be Catholic and whose livelihood and retirement depend on protecting this fiction. Nor should you fool yourselves into thinking that you are sending a son or daughter to a Catholic institution if it does not live up to the church's standards. Secular universities, he says, have many problems, but claiming to be Catholic is not one of them. End of quote. Now, is that straight talk? I don't get any straighter than that. But it's not any more blunt than the language once used by Ellen White when Adventist young people were in peril. Series B of Special Testimonies, number 7, page 35. Some people think it strange that I write, do not send your children to Battle Creek. And then she said, the young people in Battle Creek are in danger. They will come in contact with error. Fundamentals of Christian Education, page 350, says it would be far better to cease seeking an education than to gain the best of educations and lose sight of eternal advantages. Yeah, I know. I understand fully. C. John McCloskey is a Catholic priest. And we have a lot of differences with Catholics. But as I think about what I've just read to you folk here, the language in his article, a statement, one more statement from Ellen White comes to my mind. It comes from Selected Messages, Book 3, page 386. There are many souls to come out of the churches, even the Catholic Church, whose zeal will far exceed that of those who have stood in the rank and file to proclaim the truth heretofore. When the crisis is upon us, when the season of calamity shall come, they will come to the front and they will exalt his law. And then I read Chaplain McCloskey's article one more time, and I discover you go through that article and you change the word Catholic to Adventist. And you have some advice that could save a lot of parents a lot of heartache. And so we go back now to the words of Jesus. And he answered and said unto them, I tell you, that if these should hold their peace, the stones would immediately cry out. Now next time, next hour when we get together, which should be in, what, a little over half an hour, I think, now, What I want to do is share something with you that not an awful lot of people have heard. But it's something that I think you really need to know. On my Catholic alma mater, on the campus there, one day I was browsing through the research stacks in the library. They have an extremely fine library. It's a very wealthy institution. It's very well endowed. And I was looking, quite honestly, for something out of the post-conciliar documents of Vatican II, of which they have a complete collection. Well, in the process of looking for that, I bumped into another book, a little purple book. And the title on the cover reached out and grabbed me like a neon sign. Because it was written by two Jesuit priests, one of whom is world class. Until his death in 1984, he's one of the best known theologians in the world. His name is Karl Rahner. He's a German, or was a German Jesuit. The title of the book is Unity of the Churches, an Actual Possibility. Well, whenever I see something by a Jesuit talking about end time issues, I make the time to read it. And when I got inside, I discovered an eightfold plan to erase the Reformation, reunite the whole Protestant world under the umbrella of Rome, and it is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Now, in the last couple of years, you folk have begun to see in your newspapers and magazines a lot of very strange headlines. Headlines like, Evangelicals Reach Out to Catholics. Evangelicals and Catholics Together, Lutheran Catholic Dialogue, over and over and over again. Time magazine last December names who as Man of the Year? Pope John Paul II. There is a massive effort right now to reunify the Christian faith. It received an enormous boost just last week, and if you read USA Today, you may have seen the news item on page 1. A few days ago, USA Today, down in the lower left-hand corner, there's an article about something the Pope said last Sunday. Just last Sunday. He issued a formal apology to the world for the sins of the Catholic Church and said, we know we've made mistakes in the past and we're sorry for it and we ask you forgiveness. In one brilliant stroke, he's absolutely destroyed any ability of people to say, look at the past, that's the reason we don't want to unify in the future. When we get together next hour, I'm going to read that to you, that statement of the Pope, and then I'm going to show you what is happening as recently as 1993 in Mexico when Protestants were shot down in front of their families for daring to try to proselytize to the Protestant faith. And then I'm going to share with you that book, that fascinating 8-step program to abolish the Reformation. When I'm done, you're going to have accomplished two things. Number one, you're going to understand the headlines. What you're seeing in the headlines is not an accidental force of history. This stuff's planned, and it's deep into its advanced stages. But number two, you're going to understand why Adventism is facing some of the pressures we're facing today. Because the Jesuit plan says we work on the targeted churches not from outside, but from within. So we have an interesting hour ahead of us. We'll get ourselves a little bit of rest and recreation, get some fresh air, and then I hope we can get together and really say some things that'll make sense to you and be of help to you in the future. Thank you.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.